Welcome to another episode of Money for Nothing, the podcast about music and capitalism. I'm Saxon Baird with Sam Becker as always. Sam, what do you recall the first time you ever did karaoke?
That's an incredible question. No.
Mine was at this like... My first time I ever really did karaoke was at this like Chinese restaurant that no longer exists in like Portland, Oregon. And they used to do, I think, like daily karaoke.
Whoa.
Which is like pretty intense. Yeah. And I remember like it was on this like really main street. And so like cars could drive by and like see everybody like, and you could drive by and like see all the people because the windows were like totally like not dimmed, tinted or anything. Yeah.
Sure.
It was kind of cool. Yeah. And then I remember one time there was actually like a fire outside of the Chinese restaurant, and because I don't know, like somebody like flicked an ash into a bush or whatever. Anyways, like the fire truck came and everything, they got rid of it, and then they let us back in to do karaoke, and I was up, and so clearly we didn't start the fire by Billy Joel, because like what else are you gonna do at that point?
Wait, so you had a choice of like what karaoke
I asked them to change it
song you didn't have to put it
yeah and okay. I asked them to change it and they were down. He found it and did it. It seemed appropriate. If you're wondering why we're talking about karaoke, well, that is the topic of today's episode. A little history, a little business, a little political economy, a little theory. You know how this the show works. So Sam, before we dive into a relatively concise history of karaoke, I want to start this conversation around the way that we as participants of karaoke as a society, as people, interact with recorded music. Obviously, we don't need to give an explanation of what karaoke is. Everybody knows what that is that's listening. So, like, let's dive in. Like, basically, you know, karaoke obviously is the development and its subsequent popularity is a story about technology and globalization and capitalism. But, like, why it's so popular is also about recorded music and our relationship to it. So before we dive into the history of itself, like what is our contemporary relationship to recorded music and how is it evolved? And maybe that'd be a way to kind of like framework this entire conversation, for this episode.
Yeah, no, I mean, like we talk a lot in the show about like commodities and commodity flows and artists recording and listening, and karaoke is this like, I almost feel like it's like this tributary. Like, it's like if the river is like traditionally that people engage with recorded music, the karaoke is this like major tributary off it. It's this like really big way that people interact with recorded music that tells us something about how people are imagining what recorded music is, who the singer is, what is happening when someone's singing a song. But also, like, I feel like gives, not to get too Freudian here for a second.
Oh, please get Freudian.
But, like, it's sort of the, like, return of the repressed of folk music, of recorded music, right?
Damn.
It's like the flip side of recorded music, in that a recorded, you know, songs circulate, people perform them for each other. Recorded music is this idea that in many ways it's like there is one singer somewhere out there that you have this parasocial relationship to, and this is the like putting yourself in the place of that person but in a limited context again. So it's like both grabbing the universality of pop music, but like instantiating it like it was folk music. Like, it's right here. Don't Stop Believing only exists for the 8 people in this room, but also it exists in a different way because we all know that Don't Stop Believing exists outside of this room. It's really this like funny, complicated thing. And I think that that's important because as we get, as we've discussed many times in the show, like pushing towards a social media future, right? Like where everyone is a performer of cultural content,
right?
Now,
right,
at some level, or most people are. Like, it's a karaoke world and we just live in it, baby.
Yeah, so much more now, I feel like, with TikTok. I really like what you're saying, because I think that it kind of, karaoke in a way is kind of like that middle ground between like the concert and like you and your car singing along. It's like we have these intimate relationships with music, which then when we like go to like a massive concert, we realize that like the intimate relationship we have with music or a song or a band is like shared by like, you know, hundreds, thousands of other people. But right. Like we're all together in it. Like
you only go to very small concerts.
Yeah, that's truly. But
the relationship with this song is shared by up to 250 other people.
Yeah, F that. You know, we're all still kind of like in the same. We're like in the venue watching the band perform. You know, all sharing this together. But then like in between there is karaoke, where like we're the performer itself. But usually it's usually not that many people, let's say usually just a handful of friends, maybe like upwards of like guess like 50-60 people. There's actually a bar here in Berlin that actually a queue actually forms to get into this one karaoke bar like Thursday through Sunday, so maybe a little bit more people at that place. But yeah, I like it. It's kind of like this like middle ground. I like the connection to it being a kind of like, I don't know, contemporary folk music in a way, but also like our relationship to recorded music is evolving as like technology evolves, which is kind of in many ways like the history or major aspect of the history,
right,
of
totally
of karaoke. So let's dive into the history, and it can be like a bit arbitrary where to start. Obviously there's a long history of human singing publicly together both in Western traditions and elsewhere. Of course that includes Japan and throughout Eastern Asia and other places, but I think that like where karaoke was really first popularized and created is considered Japan.
Yes,
and I think for definitely. Our episode, I guess we're gonna start in Japan and with Shigechi Nagishi, who died this past January at the age of 100. And I think he really invented the first karaoke machine, or like proto karaoke machine.
Yeah. So this was really interesting. So this was like the initial, we've been wanting to do a karaoke episode for a while, because it's fascinating. Like, honestly,
I mean, we could definitely do that. Like, we could do like 8 parts if we really needed to.
Oh, I know. So we're gonna have to, might like
so many good stories.
And we might like do another episode at some point, just because there's, as we'll mention, there's karaoke all over the world and it functions differently all over the world. There's also like an endless, like it's such an interesting vantage point into so many different parts of the music industry. Like we're not even going to really dig into, I only started to dig into the financials of Sunfly Industries.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so many aspects, and then also there's really like great like anecdotes and stories and like apocryphal like myths around it and everything. I mean, it's like, it's such a rich topic. So we'll keep it to like a little over an hour, but
yeah,
like, yeah, for our, that's the so-called inventor. I mean, the generally considered inventor of the first karaoke machine. Yeah. He died this past January at 100. And I think that's probably where we're starting. So what exactly did he invent?
So that was what was funny. So we have been, like I said, been wanting to do this episode for a while. And when Shigechi Nagishi died, it was like, oh, this is like a good moment to like think about, because it's kind of an amazing thing. You're like, how could this thing that has become in some ways integral to how people understand popular recorded music, right? Like that no, we don't really have a million bar bands anymore, but we do have a nation of karaoke singers, all of whom are willing to step temporarily and through like fantasy into the shoes of their famous pop singer of choice. We have a nation of guitar band players. We have a nation of rock band players, right? Of dance, right? All of these things that clearly come out of the karaoke model. How could like one person have invented it? That's insane. Like that it's my like go-to, this is really silly, but like my go-to example of like a piece of pop culture that somehow like I can't believe there was a time before it is usually like the Van Morrison's Brown Eyed Girl. Like it blows my mind that there was a period of time before the intro to Brown Eyed Girl, like most of human history. It's a relatively recent development, but I'm like, you, like people were
let alone recorded
music. Yeah, yeah, but people were like walking around before anyone went like do 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 do, right? It's unbelievable. And similarly, like, I feel like karaoke is one of those things.
Wait, movies were made without that? Without that?
I know. Like 30 years.
Popular movies were made? Yeah, strange. Wow, okay. Anyways.
Oh, so you get it, too. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very weird. Pre-Brown-Eyed Girl, a time in history. Similarly, I felt like karaoke was one of those things that I couldn't believe, like, someone had invented. And then I dug into it. And reader, listener, lo and behold... no one invented karaoke. There are like, so the current like official inventor, because we have a desperate search for the purity of origin, is Shigeshi Nagishi. But there are like four or five people, all of whom like living in Japan, like either in Tokyo or Osaka, where they invent karaoke at something like karaoke at roughly the same time. And so this very much does feel like, as much as and Shigeshi is the first one who invents a commercialized karaoke machine, and like makes that as a widely accessible piece of technology that then gets picked up, there's a bunch of different individual inventors who are inventing something like that. And maybe that the fact that it's actually, and maybe this goes to the depth of the form, right? It's actually extremely difficult,
right,
if not impossible, to copyright karaoke. It's why karaoke is not a brand, right? The way Walkman is, the way Sony is, the way many things are. Karaoke means in Japanese, empty orchestra. So... what's fascinating is like, yeah, it's almost impossible to copyright, because there's basically, this is like taking recorded music, recording a version of it without vocals, and then giving people the option to sing on top of it. So in some ways, like, I feel like it's centrality to record, like, the fact that it couldn't be copyright to me reflects like how it is recorded, like integral to recorded music in some way, right? Like, there's not quite a there. Instead, there's like a set of social practices that change in different places and different conditions. There are different technologies, so like the ability to have a song in different keys, the absolutely crucial echo that makes everyone sound halfway decent. But actually, like, this emerges out of like a broader set of dynamics that are happening in Japanese culture in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, right? So you've got, as you gesture towards Saxon, like this tradition of singing in public. With all this stuff, like, people tie it back to these like ancient folk traditions, which I think like at some level, like, yes, that is, I'm sure, true, and at another level is unnecessary, in that, as you pointed out, that like most humans sing in public. There's very few societies where like no one sing ever. That said, that there's a couple of like direct antecedents. Piano bars, which were an importation from America, were really popular in Japan from the 20s onwards. So this, if anyone's actually had the, there's a couple still around. There's a couple in like around Broadway that are kind of sick. If you've ever been to one of those, Saxon.
Been to one in San Diego, out of all places. And Oakland.
No, that makes sense somehow. Yeah, you know, they're these, now they're kind of a throwback, but back in the day, it was like, there was a piano player.
Singing songs.
They would play songs.
Sing along.
People would, and everyone would sing along. Then there are these kind of traveling bar performers that do a similar thing, but like move from bar to bar and let people sing the most common pop songs. Karaoke evolves out of this. In particular, one of the potential inventor karaoke, Daisuke Inui. I apologize for my poor Japanese pronunciation.
We'll just call him what they called him in Japan, the granddaddy of karaoke. And why they call him that?
So yeah, so he's a pianist. He was like the best person. He was the best person in Tokyo, right? I believe either Tokyo or Osaka. Amazing at performing this kind of piano bar music for people. And eventually he got too many clients and started, his clients were like, wait, we're having this party. We want you to be there. He's like, I had a gig that day. And they're like, can't you just record a tape of you playing and we'll sing over it? And he's like, sure, that's a great idea. So he does that. He records a tape. He gives it to them. It goes great at the party. And he's like, oh, I can be in more than one place. And the kind of breakthrough for him is... he had a client who had particularly bad tempo, was like really bad. And he was like, well, if I play it right, he can't sing to it. But if I play it kind of wrong, he'll be able to sing to it great. So he plays it intentionally wrong. The guy is like, this is the best tape I've ever had. He seems like constitutionally opposed to trying to copyright these technologies, by the way. He plays for a while, then he gets out of the game. Karaoke goes on to worldwide success and fame. And he gets back into the game by patenting a cockroach killer for the karaoke machines.
Yeah, which at the time, I guess, were like installed at bars and like other places. And like, I guess he was saying the cockroaches would eat through the wires. So he made like a specific like cockroach trap for karaoke machines, which
like makes sense. People spill drinks on them. It's like the object that's most likely to be spilled on in the entire world is a karaoke machine.
If not your shirt. Yeah. Which is just, I think, kind of describes one of the many like amazing sort of stories about that illustrate this first kind of like, I don't know, 20, 30 years of like the development of karaoke in Japan. So, I mean, karaoke basically goes on in Japan to become an integral part of modern Japanese culture, but really gains popularity as a kind of first, as like a form of like networking icebreaker between employees of essentially like white collar business salesman types, which is like extremely right. Different from the US, which we'll get to later. But essentially it's like a team building exercise. Essentially, you go to the bar with your primarily male counterparts after work, you get drunk, you sing songs, y'all make fools of each other, and then it's basically a, kind of was seen as a way of like team building, essentially.
Again, all of this goes to this like very, this incredibly fertile moment. So what you have here is create, you know, this massive consumer electronics boom in Japan, right, from the 60s onwards. So this is the kind of device, like taking several relatively simple devices, bringing them together in a creative new way, and then building a new set of social practices around those devices is like Japan is remaking the world by doing precisely that in this period of time. And so I feel like karaoke is the perfect distillation of that post-war inventiveness. And the flip side of that, and this is the new social practice, is what you're talking about in these business folks, is that there's this, you know, this famously intense work culture where at one level it's team building exercise, at another level it's like there's no escape from work.
Yeah, it's the modern equivalent of like Google like putting in like a yoga room and a meditation room and like a bring your dog to work thing just to keep you at work and make you happy kind of thing. It's like almost like a modern version, or like this, that's the modern version of it. I would be surprised if Google does like karaoke nights like in the office.
So I mean, there's also like I think a lot of interesting a lot of deals got made in karaoke. And there's this whole, there was some fascinating stuff we read that there's a lot of really interesting kind of ethnography about and writers like researching karaoke culture and in Japan, especially in the 80s and 90s, and like these very specific rules about what you were supposed to sing, what you're not supposed to sing. Like, how does that relate to, like, the hierarchical structures of an office? Like, you shouldn't sing anything your boss doesn't know.
Or doesn't like.
Or doesn't like. So it's this very complicated. And there's this whole tricky thing for female employees because this is this very male space. There's this whole hostess culture in many of these karaoke bars. And so this complicated, like, social, economic, cultural, gender, technological, gender dynamic in these all, you know, performing both Japanese pop songs, but also this kind of circuit of international pop, much of it American.
Right. Yeah. And then eventually it does start to kind of like break out of these boundaries in the Japanese culture of like just being for businessmen. Like women start getting involved. It starts like the development of like karaoke machines. It starts to become this much more like popular form and basically just sweeps the nation and is now like an integral part of its culture. But like during this process, there's also a really great little story about how like because it became so popular, you'd have like these neighborhoods with bars having karaoke, and like they'd be going on until late into the night, and then people would start complaining, the neighbors, about all these people drunkenly singing. So that's actually how the development of the karaoke box came about, was that there was too many bars with not enough good soundproof and houses with not enough good soundproof. And obviously, like, this is one story, but like that apparently it was annoying people. So then people started, so the Japanese in Japan they started creating these like karaoke boxes, and like one of the earliest forms of karaoke box was that they would do them out of the back of like trucks, like in kind of more rural areas, or like shipping containers. And it would just be like,
sick,
you would just like go to the shipping container and do karaoke until like 2 a.m. and get wasted and then like walk home or something.
Right,
The one thing you were assured of is that none of the neighbors would get mad, and like the bar wouldn't get into trouble. In a way, it's kind of like also like the the contemporary version of that is like, I don't know, those like party buses or something.
Except everyone gets
I don't know.
just for being
a thing. But I think obviously, like we said, like there's like a really extensive history about how it goes on to just basically completely take over Japan and become such an integral part of its culture, and then like start spreading out throughout the rest of like East Asia and other places. But I think that, like, you know, maybe moving on to how it like came over here to the US, it's also like a really wonderful, interesting story that I guess you could say started on a blackjack game on the Queen Elizabeth II. So as it turns out, I guess we're talking like probably like late 70s, early 80s. Earl Glick of Hal Roach Studios, which I guess was famous for producing shorts of like Laurel and Hardy and like Our Gang, was on the Queen Elizabeth II cruise ship, I guess. And a Japanese gentleman by the name of Kei Tagaki, once again, apologies for the name, the pronunciation, was watching basically this Earl Glick guy just like lose like hand after hand after hand. And he was basically running out of money. And I guess Tagaki like threw him like 4,000, and then like basically Glick ended up earning it all back. So the next day they like meet back on the boat to like, you know, pay off the debts or whatever. And I guess the ship was like on the way to Japan. And so, make a long story short, like, turns out Tagaki was the inventor of one of these really popular karaoke machines at the time called the Singing Game, and basically tried to get Glick to bring them over to the U.S. Glick, like, wasn't about it. Somehow he eventually became about it. He ordered, like, 8,000 of them, and they would, like, literally, like try to market these outside of supermarkets. Like, there'd just be somebody with a karaoke machine in the middle of the day in the parking lot of like Los Angeles, like trying to like sing and like sell these singing game karaoke boxes. Well, it turns out, according to Glick, it didn't go so well, but it did get the eye and the ear of one gentleman named Sal Ferrero, who had a bar in Los Angeles called Dimples, and he installed it at Dimples, and Dimples went on to be the self-described as the first karaoke bar in the Western Hemisphere, which is debatable, but I think it's largely considered historically to be the first karaoke bar in America.
Yeah, and karaoke has, you know, all of these global histories. I mean, legendary in the Philippines, clearly, is probably the country that's most famous, besides Japan, most famous for its karaoke. And they're different karaoke cultures. I mean, and it's one of the fascinating things. And again, it's about, in some ways, it reminds me a little bit of the cassette tape, in that it's this moment where global, you know, if you think about the emergence of mass culture and the emergence of commoditized, industrially produced mass culture as a moment that is a lot about, it's about broadcasting, both kind of at a local level, like everyone's tuned into the same radio station. So cities are united in different ways. Areas, localities, regionalities are united in different ways. But also at a global level, you start having these massive culture industries where nothing had been like Hollywood before Hollywood, right? The ability to generate and then disseminate, project really culture. You know, everyone knows who Cary Grant. Everyone knew who Cary Grant was. Everyone knew who Humphrey Bogart was.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone knew who Marilyn Monroe was. Still does, right?
Right.
But what you get in this slightly later moment is that you get these circulating texts, and then they do this kind of like amazing dialectical things that texts do, which is that the readers start making universes around them. And these new technologies, and I think that the uptake of this technology is really about that. Is like, we have these texts, but we want to make them our own, or we want to relocalize them. And so karaoke allows you to do that again at this micro level, and that you are singing the mass cultural songs in this fascinating way. Like, you're stepping in for global, right? In some ways, you're appropriating global capital to your voice.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you're also kind of saying though that like this is also kind of what it sounds like you're describing is like the development of like the pop star, with like the Cary Grant reference, right? In the sense that like these stars are actually in a way to kind of like support these like industries, in a sense, and like keep them, create like my markets around these industries, like around the movies. You have tabloids, you have like, you know, whatever else, you know.
Sure.
Yeah. And then so it's interesting. So do you think like in a sense, would you also consider that like karaoke is maybe in some way a sort of offshoot of like the pop stardom culture of music, of like modern contemporary music industry?
Yeah, I think that's right. But in some ways it's like postmodern pop culture, and by postmodern I'm talking very specifically if you think about like 80s, 90s, 2000s. I think we're in a moment that's after that cultural moment now. It's really annoying because like
post whatever
people like need to stop calling things modern, because it's really confusing and annoying for everything that happens after it. Everyone's like, no, this is the final stage of history, guys. It's like, it's one of my favorite things. We've probably talked about this on this podcast before. It's like the litter of history of literary movements all called the new thing in a different language.
Right. Right.
And
nouveau.
Yeah. Art nouveau.
Yeah.
but in some ways that like 40s, 50s, 60s moment is the generation of this increasingly global pop culture and pop cultural landscape. Like, it can't be not just contained by these industries, like it ends up being localized in all these different ways. And I think, again, like karaoke is this beautiful example because it's localized at the individual level, right? In that it's literally you in a room with friends or enemies or non-acquaintances. Actually, I take it back. No one's a non-acquaintance in a karaoke room. You're either a friend or an enemy, but like there's nothing else. But also, I think that the way that karaoke culture more generally gets localized, that there's this set of distinct national karaoke cultures, all with their own set of like standards and practices and traditions, and none of them are the real karaoke culture. There's no original. I mean, there is like Japan, but at this point they're all have these distinct different karaoke cultures. And so it's really interesting that in the United States you kind of do get these multiple waves of American karaoke. So
yeah, no, exactly. And I think that as much as we would love to dive into all the various karaoke cultures, and I do truly mean that, I think we're gonna go ahead and focus a little bit just on the this sort of brand of like American karaoke, and I think that it's really interesting. So coming out of a place like Dimples, obviously, like spread in the next 15, 20, 25 years to what we have now all over this country. But it really kind of began as a sort of working class bars, dive bars is kind of really began here in the US, which is quite the opposite of Japan, where it actually did start with kind of white collar businessmen, as we mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that in the US, and again, this is one of those areas where like it kind of blew my mind. I mean, there's a couple books written about this, though none of them feel, all due respect to our anthropologist brothers and sisters, but like there's the ethnology to like basic historical chronology of American karaoke is way out of whack. It's like there's a lot of like participant observer analysis of what it means to sing karaoke, and not that much about like who are the companies, where have they been, what kind of songs are on the karaoke machines? What are their relationship to the Japanese corporations? Are they importing? Do they have, you know, are these Japanese? Like, there's a lot of historical work, like calling all cultural historians. Like, there's a lot of work to be done on karaoke in America. But it does seem like what you're saying, Saxon, is that there is this, like, I think, tripartite evolution a little bit. Like, initially, it's this Japanese, and let's be real, America is in many ways an orientalizing nation, and so it was understood as like Asian, like pan Asian, like you, like for instance, you,
right,
Japan and China, colon different countries, but your first karaoke, karaoke experience was in a Chinese restaurant, and like no one cared.
No, and I think I see what you're saying. You're also saying that, like, you know, obviously, like,
it was being branded, and
they felt like this is the best way to market, what would be to just like market as like pan Asian, or like, you know, if you were from Vietnam, like have a Vietnam like portion of the menu, but actually you're, you know, also serving like Chinese food and like Japanese food. And so it is considered like this sort of like definitely in the States, unfortunately, the specifics are often getting like tossed.
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's this initial move where it's like maybe a karaoke Mach 1 is like this kind of understood as like quote unquote broadly pan-Asian, and probably, and this would be fascinating, I guess, would guess functions differently on the West Coast, in which like the Asian population is much bigger. Certainly like LA karaoke hits different than New York karaoke in many ways, in terms of like where it's set up and how long those places have been doing karaoke nights, the extent to which there's like the person running a karaoke night, which is like a beautiful and in some ways dying art form. But I think so, like, the initially it was understood as this Japanese, but like broadly in the American imaginary, pan-Asian import, and tied to specifically a set of kind of like, again, like in the biggest possible scare quotes, like Asian cultural spaces or people wanting like these experiences. And I think it was presented that way in pop culture. And then there was this kind of move, I think I would imagine partially because of the spaces in which that initial, you know, like we're saying restaurants, bars, that there wasn't this karaoke set up. And because America has a different set of like physical infrastructure than Japan does, certainly, in which like lots of little small rooms make a ton of sense in Tokyo, and that's just like not how New York or LA are built, that you get this kind of, this broader move into kind of the Americanization of karaoke over the 90s and 2000s, where it does, as you're saying, become this kind of broad working class practice. And in doing so, it's very much not the small private room system that is kind of the prevalent that's prevalent in Japan, where you're singing for small groups of friends. It's much more of a karaoke night where a singer gets up in front of a crowd of people, of both strangers and friends, at a bar and sings for all of them, and kind of this long waiting, like the sense that you do a good song and you wait a long time for your turn to sing. Is it the distinctly American karaoke culture, which is not something I realized quite before doing this that's like how karaoke was instantiated in America. And then I think finally in the third, there's been this kind of, with a kind of, I would say like a new turn to Japanese culture, partially because of the internet, in partially because of changing demographics in the United States in the last 10 years. I think that this idea, that this expansion of like authentic karaoke spaces, ones that are much more along the model that's prevalent in Japan. Like, I don't think I did private room karaoke. Maybe this is just money. They're slightly more expensive, like, and how old I am. But like, I didn't do private room karaoke until a little more than a decade ago, if not less. And now I feel like most of the places I go to, like, that's the main option is like private room karaoke. As like another moment in karaoke culture.
Yeah, that's developed here in the States. Yeah, so you kind of see this history as you described that you developed, but like I think at first it really was. I found it really interesting that it was really kind of criticized, I have the quotes, but I don't need to read them. But there was like all this like quotes from like the New York Times and all these like major who were really kind of like bashing the act of karaoke. And then like even if you were going to describe a bar, like if it had karaoke like one night, it was like a mark against it. And I should have looked up who the writer was, but like God bless the Village Voice, like in like 1991 they wrote a review of like some place and they actually gave like a positive review about it because it had karaoke, but it was still in relation to the fact that like the beer was cheap, it was open late, you know, it was like affordable, like kind of thing where it's like, oh, here's a really good dive bar and they also have karaoke, so you know they're like a legit dive bar. So obviously, like, as you can see just from that, there's like it really has developed and from there into like this thing that actually really is kind of everywhere regardless of place or economic status. And there was this interesting book that I read, I think it was karaoke that we read for this, I think it was called Karaoke Nights, and you know, he kind of outlines how also during this time, like the late 90s, early 2000s, that these sort of more middle class white collar bars would started to integrate karaoke. But that he claims, and maybe this is more of like an anthropological sort of look at things, but he claims that there was a sort of irony about the way that the middle class white collar bars would perform karaoke, in the sense that they were kind of like performing in a way to like make fun of the karaoke singer, while there was a lot more earnestness and like sort of actual embodiment of this fantasy for the in the more working class bars. I mean, you know, it's an interesting idea and one that is like worth considering. But I do think that today this distinction doesn't really hold any more weight because of the fact that it's just become so ubiquitous, regardless of city, like economic status or anything, which actually I think makes it even kind of in a way more powerful, because you could walk into a place and you could sing with or perform next aside, or like watch, you know, somebody who's like, you know, a C-suite executive belting out a Taylor Swift song, and then like, you know, the trash man or, you know, bartender will get up and like do something else as well. So it's actually kind of like a bringing together of all that now. I feel like there really isn't that divide.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot in that. I mean, one of the things, yeah, as you were saying, that was fascinating about this was a chance to like check out reading about hipsters' take on karaoke in the 90s and 2000s. I mean, and by hipsters, I mean like primarily, though not exclusively,
third wave.
ska fans. No. the kind of like primarily white, primarily upper middle class, high cultural capital, college educated knowledge workers that
knowledge workers
that are the I-95 corridor, baby, you know, go on to define that are so important to like that are so influential on culture in the 90s and 2000s. I mean, it's the upper middle class, right? That remain influential today. But what's fascinating is like how much some of these discourses have changed. Like, and this is where you get like poptimism is, or at least like the changing cultural consensus around pop music has fundamentally shifted. Like in the Nirvana era, people would maybe get up and ironically sing pop songs. But the idea that there was a value in these commodities, and that there was a value to like embodying them and performing them, really wasn't there. And so there
was an unrecognized like market that was completely untapped into, I think, or very
unrecognized. I would say like actively hostile, but it's just fascinating. Yeah, not so much true. That like karaoke conquered them, I would say, as like that group of people fundamentally shifted their vision on how cultural practices, like what how one should relate to popular culture. And it's fascinating to think about something that's so embodied as karaoke, right? Like, and we'll talk about this more, you know, towards the end, but like, it's this incredible, like, you get up and you sing, and there's something like, for all of the commoditization of culture, for all of the ways in which, you know, music is about, recorded music is about, like, some deep level, like, alienation from the places of musical production, and then the circulation of that for profit, like, you get up and you sing your little heart out, and it's a deeply human experience. It's like why it's like why we have voices. Why we have voices is to sing, Saxon. And like, as like over the top of that sounds, like, at some level I do believe that. It's like, and there's like, not like, there's fascinating evolutionary stuff about like why human beings sing together. Like, it's a way of creating group cohesion that's much faster than grooming each other, because like, we're monkeys, but like, we're monkeys that operate in bigger groups. I mean, that's pretty far afield from this, but I do think there's something like fundamentally human about singing in groups, and you do that. And so in a karaoke room, and thinking about like, it's very easy to look back in the 90s and be like, in many ways, it's a very similar time. Certain elements change, you know, beliefs, you know, certainly like the expansion of LGBTQ plus liberation, various views on gender. But also like, when I think about like, it wasn't cool to get up and sing, I'm like, whoa, that's like a very different cultural moment. Like, profoundly different.
I mean, I would argue it's still not cool, but that maybe that's kind of like the point, that it's almost like kind of a breaking down of that, those sort of like false cultural barriers of taste.
Or cool doesn't have the meaning it did. Those structures of cool don't have the meaning they did. Or that people can go in and out of cool things more easily. No, I think you're right. It's not cool, but like you don't carry the taint of karaoke with you after you leave the room.
Yeah, like, oh, that guy's saying karaoke, I can't hang out with him. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, nobody's doing that, even if you don't like it, for sure. It's such like a, it's just so ubiquitous at this point. Yeah, I mean, maybe like, to like slide into like the last half of this, or the last third of this episode, I'm kind of curious, like, maybe like the relationship that it has to more directly to the music industry, and also thinking about something we mentioned at the top of the show, which is like its relationship to like TikTok, you know, like, does TikTok even exist without karaoke and the popularity of karaoke? Does it in some way, even also social media, does it help karaoke, or does it actually in some way kind of like take away from it? And from these sort of communal aspects in which you were talking about, like, now are happening in this like isolated square frame of a reel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe to start, like, I mean, maybe let's just like kind of like break down, like, I mean, I don't know, like what role does like karaoke play when it comes to sort of like the bigger, you know, capital music industry? Because I was kind of thinking about this a little bit, and it's something I've never thought about when you think about like the legacy of like songs and the lasting power of songs, is like how much karaoke contributes to that. And I think especially in relation to things that we've talked about on this show, about not only when we talk about those catalogs being sold, and we would talk about like the diminishing returns of, say, like, you know, Mark Ronson's catalog and like Amy Winehouse's music. And so it's like worth him to like sell it, you know, now. But in a sense, it's like maybe those diminishing returns, or maybe the popularity of some of these songs would actually fall off the sort of cultural consciousness like a little bit quicker nowadays, considering the fact that like, there's like radio has become like less important and so on. But in a way, like, I feel like karaoke kind of maybe in a way keeps the life of songs going maybe like a little bit longer than maybe they would without it, or at least it like contributes in some way.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think that when we think about karaoke as part of the music industry, it's this lovely complicating factor. The way I'm increasingly thinking about the music industry, which is kind of, like I said before, with that kind of labored tributary analogy, it's like, I think the music industry has got primary commodity thrusts, and then those primary commodity thrusts often create like reactive secondary forces of commoditization and social practice that often are kind of related in dialectical ways to them, and the industry makes profit off of all of them. But all of those kind of create this multiple sets of temporalities and multiple sets of cultural relationships and cultural practices that we use to interact with pop music, all of which connect to shape our understanding of what pop music is and what music is, and kind of all of which make this really messy, super complicated picture. So if at one level, if you think about pop music as being about the new, right? And that's like it's the defining innovation of the modern music industry, is that they're like, holy moly, this is like 1890, holy moly, we can get people to buy new songs. Because like, songs don't go bad on their own, right? they don't go bad. Like, there's nothing wrong with an old song. You just need to convince people that the new song is better in some way. And so you create the introduction of fashion to musical practice is like crucial. And like you're saying, radio is an important complicating factor. There's top 40 radio. I mean, in some ways, another push through all of this is like, radio used to be almost exclusively top 40 radio. You get like progressive freeform FM radio in the 60s, where you start getting older tracks and album tracks. But like, it's until fairly recently, the idea like classic rock is a major innovation and something we should probably do an episode on in the future. But yeah, I mean, I think that karaoke is fascinating, right? It's like, if pop music's all about new, karaoke is about like the opposite of that in many ways. Like, yeah, you can sing a brand new hit song in karaoke, but at least in America, the way people do it is very rarely are they singing. I don't know if I've ever seen someone sing a song from less than a year.
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, I would just say
like minimum a year old.
Yeah. Well, I got a couple of thoughts on that. Like, one, I think because like the technology to turn around and like get a karaoke version of a hip song in less than a year is only till like recently. Like when I first started karaoke like 10 years ago, it's like you still were like looking through a book kind of, I think,
right?
You know, not 10 years ago, longer than that, but you get the point. So first of all, that's limited as well. But then, second of all, it is interesting. I was just thinking about this in a way that, like, possibly karaoke could act as this filter for, like, what ends up becoming, like, a hit long term,
yeah,
like, and, like, lasting. Because the thing is, like,
yeah,
the thing that we talked about also a lot is just how kind of, like, time is flattened. You know, you have TikTok videos that are blowing up from, like, obscure songs on, like, a beach house record from, like, 15 years ago. And they're going to the concert. You know, 19-year-olds are going to the concert, et cetera, et cetera. So it'd be kind of interesting, like, how karaoke pivots from that. And maybe it's just a technology where, like, literally you can find a karaoke song of any song ever. Maybe it turns into that. But maybe it also, depending on if we can somehow get numbers or some sort of statistics, or maybe, yeah, I don't know what else could be provided. But in a way, like, I'm thinking about how like karaoke could act as this sort of filter that like, these are the songs that will define the 2020s, where like, it feels like there really isn't those definable like moments and songs, or they're like sort of fleeting. But then like in 10 years, 15, 20 years time, like, what people are singing for a karaoke from like 2022.
Yeah, it's how we make the selections.
Was right? How we'll make the selection, exactly. Yeah, or it is how we'll make the selections. Yeah, you're right.
It's how exactly we make the selections, and I think it lets us, you know, chart these songs, get meaning through their human interactions, and as you sing them, and the memory
yeah,
that
it develops becomes more important.
That
yeah,
accrete around these songs. You know, I mean, I think that an excellent example is, There's been some like writing and analysis of this, which is like, Mr. Brightside, right? Mr. Brightside was not the biggest hit off the Killers album when it was released. It like didn't it charted, didn't chart particularly highly, but like that has become the defining and one of the biggest songs of the 2000s. It's played at every wedding. It's people sing it all the time at karaoke. It's like an iconic song. And it's because the, you know, I mean, none of the other songs of the Killers album, that first Killers album, have really survived in any meaningful way. There's the I've Got Soul, But I'm Not a Soldier.
Oh my God, song. I don't even know what that is. Oh no. Weddings is like another way of actually seeing this as well. I mean, I used to work, I think I've mentioned this probably on the podcast, but I used to work as a bartender at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens during the summer and did like probably have like worked like over 200 weddings, like no joke. And it's like, yeah, there's like the same sort of 7 or 8 songs. But like even if you play them in a wedding, you play them in multiple weddings and people like hear them a lot. And then they're, you know, and then you bring in this also like karaoke aspect of it. It really does kind of create this whole other personal relationship to that song by creating these like memories and like keeping it alive. And like, you know, even if the song came out 8, 9, 10 years ago. Yeah. And so it'd be kind of interesting to see how that actually maybe works against the way that like TikTok works, where it's like, yeah, maybe a song gets revived. The band that goes on tour, they recorded it 8 years ago, is like, oh, this is like part of like a viral TikTok hit. And so we need to play it into our set now. But how much do the revival of these songs or the sort of pulling out of these obscure tracks for a social media reel? Like,
oh, does it like disrupt? Does it disrupt the? Yeah, I mean, so
which I also mentioned, as we're recording, like the TikTok ban did pass, which is also kind of crazy. So maybe already like my references are dated, but
yeah, but they pull out, no. I mean that Mr. Brightside point is from journalist and writer Katie Moulton, and we've actually talked about like seeing if there's like a way we can computationally like pull out, like look at DJ, because since there's been digital wedding DJs,
right,
everyone has their playlists, right. So like we're like, can we track the changing songs that are played on people's wedding playlists over time? And she had a really cool piece about Mr. Brightside in that, like how that changed things, just like credit where credit is due for like a really cool work. I think it's also interesting in that I think a lot about what singer-songwriters did to music, in that there was a sense of standards, right?
Right.
In the jazz era, this idea that there are these songs that everyone sings and everyone knows and every band, rock band plays. This idea that kind of this folk practice, like there's set of, or rather like the hangover from a moment when you couldn't hear recordings of everything, that there'd be like one way that people got the music they wanted to hear was through people performing and live. And so everyone needed to know a set of songs, and then everyone could only request a certain set of songs. So there's kind of set of shared cultural texts. And I mean, I think one of the interesting things about karaoke is the way that it creates and has, as American karaoke culture has evolved, you get this shifting set of kind of karaoke standards. And I mean, so I've done a lot of karaoke in Baltimore, which is like a really interesting city for it. It's a really diverse city in many ways. It's very segregated in other ways. Like different karaoke spots have like very different clientele along like race and gender and sexual lines. And it's interesting that, I mean, I would posit that clearly like certain karaoke songs hit, certain songs hit in different places, in different bars, but there is like a core of karaoke, like the white hot pinnacle of classic karaoke songs, you could sing in any of them in this way that I think isn't just because these are classic karaoke songs. Some of them are like I think you could sing Don't Stop Believin' at any of those bars. And some of that, I think, is because of the and this is what's
enduring
interesting, maybe
power
a
of
way
classic
to,
rock. Sorry,
no, and maybe this is a way again to bring it back to the body as like a way to start thinking about wrapping this up. Is like some of this is because it's the difficulty, uh-huh, yeah, right? Don't Stop Believing is a big song, and it's hard to sing. I can't sing
right.
Don't Stop Believing.
Yeah. Got to really belt it out.
You got to really belt it out. And so, I mean, I do think that there's this interesting thing about karaoke, which is that in a world in which people just don't have that many places to perform musical talents in a non-commodified way. I mean, there are churches, there are sure. choirs, there's bands, but there just aren't that many, like, there's like that guy with the acoustic guitar in the park for some reason. But like, there just aren't that many like socially acceptable places for displaying not like amateur musical talents. And in the past, I mean, and I think this kind of gestures towards one of the profound transformations of recordings from a world in which the vast majority of your musical experiences were produced by amateurs, right? 1900. You see, I mean, sometimes you see some professional musicians, but they're like not world famous. They're just like local professional musicians. It's a job, right? Like the fiddler, the band, the wedding band, right? They're not, and maybe occasionally you'd go to a symphony or see a traveling Broadway show with a famous singer, like to a world in which the vast majority of your musical experiences are listening to the best people in the world at music. This is this space where a huge number, like where amateur musical experience, both like the listening to musical experience and the performing of music, it's a space for it. And it's space for it. And I think some of the power, like on both, not to get like overly anthropological, but I do think that some of its power in this funny way is that even though it's constructed by capitalism, these are for-profit businesses. I think that both sides of that circuit are incredibly important, that there's something moving, like really genuinely moving about hearing someone who's not a professional singer express themselves through song. And there's something moving about doing it. But at the same time, it's like articulated on top of like, but I'm also pretending to be Katy Perry.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes or I'm pretending to be like a hardcore singer, like doing a Katy Perry cover or something like that. But yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah. And I think that just to add to that, and then maybe that's a good place to kind of wrap up. I think that you can consider it in an increasingly more alienized, atomized life. It's one of the few places or one of the few activities in which you can like naturally engage and meet strangers on a like,
yeah,
on an even level that isn't around suspicion or exploitation, you know? And like what I've said, like the only places you can naturally meet strangers nowadays is like the bar and church. And like, maybe you can ask
handball court,
court. Sure, handball court, you know, if you live in a place where like you can play handball, you know, but yeah, like, I guess you can add maybe the karaoke night to that. Maybe that's a good place to put a pin in it. Obviously, there's a lot more we could talk about in regards to karaoke and its history and all the other aspects of it, and like the business side of things. And there's a real possibility that we might do that at some point down the line, but we'll wrap up this episode. Please subscribe to our newsletter, moneyfornothing.substack.com. We are actively sending out at least one letter a week. Sometimes it doesn't actually even relate to an episode anymore. We're definitely pushing that a lot more to comment on things like the latest news that TikTok is officially now given 12 months, or ByteDance has been given 12 months to sell. But
Biden's gonna sign it.
Yeah, Biden's gonna sign it, that's for sure. Music by Bird Language, we'll be back in a couple weeks. And yeah, go ahead and sign up for that newsletter. And we'll talk to you soon. Bye.